Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up on today's program, we go deep into two Vatican offices that few people rarely see. In the first, we discover an irate Michelangelo in the archives. The general manager of the Fabrica of St. Peter's Basilica tells us what got the great maestro so hot under the collar. Then, we step inside the Vatican office responsible for interpreting the Church's canon laws to find out how the Church's universal laws are framed. It took more than 100 years to build, and decorative work on it continues to this day. The St. Peter's Basilica we know today was built over the original shrine ordered by the Emperor Constantine, on the site where the Apostle Peter was buried on Vatican Hill. Well, early in the 16th century, Pope Julius II laid the first cornerstone for the new basilica, but didn't live to see it completed decades later in 1626. Hundreds of architects, artists, and workmen have contributed to making it one of the largest and most beautiful of cathedrals in all of Christendom. And all the documents relating to the basilica's construction and embellishment are found in the archives of St. Peter's Fabrica, or Fabrique, the office responsible for the maintenance and care of the basilica. General manager of the Fabrique, Cristina Carlostella, told me the archives contain a stunning array of letters and sketches by the likes of Bernini, Michelangelo, Bramante, and Raphael.
When the Fabrique was instituted by Pope Julius II, he basically gave it the task of building the new basilica. And from that time on, beginning day one, when the keystone was founded for the new basilica.
We're talking in the 1500s.
1506. This is when the keystone of the new basilica was actually laid in the ground. And from that day on, basically even earlier than that, at the end of the 15th century, you had documents, registration, accounts that were begun and were connected with this great major undertaking of building a basilica, and that became the historic archive of the Fabrique. So we have documents that date from the late 15th century and then onwards. And that's a very, very interesting collection where quite recently even new documents, autograph documents by Michelangelo have been discovered, and even perhaps a sketch by Michelangelo, one of his preliminary sketches when he was designing part of the perimeter of the basilica. So that's a very, very exciting archival collection.
What about all of the material that would have been used in the first 1,200 years of the life of the church here in Rome? Where would those documents have been collected and stored?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I think basically the historical archive of the Fabrique deals with the very pretty nitty kind of issues, that is, administrative orders of material for the construction and the maintenance of the basilica. For any other documents, I think most of them went into the secret archives of the Vatican or in the other archival collection here in the Vatican or the Vatican Library. Okay, so the Fabrique of St. Peter's archives collection really is pretty much limited to the construction and the maintenance of the building more than other issues. Of course, you do have explorations that were done under the basilica when they had a renovating programs or renovating events, for example, around the Baldacchino area in the transept. You know, as you probably know, in 1622, 1623, in the first half of the 17th century, you had renovating work because they wanted to build the Baldacchino by Bernini, and on those occasions, they actually broke into the pavement, and by chance, by total chance, they were able to go underneath, in the levels underneath, and actually began to explore part of the Vatican Acropolis. So those kind of events were recorded, we have records of that, in the historic archive of the Fabrique.
That's quite exciting to think of Bernini exploring the necropolis, or at least the foundations of the basilica itself.
Right.
Of course, it would have been built, the Baldacchino would have been built right on top of where they believed the tomb of Peter was.
Exactly. It wasn't Bernini himself who actually, you know, did the exploration. You had men at work who were actually digging into the pavement, but I'm sure he had supervised those moments. And again, in this historical archive, we do have quite a number of autographed manuscripts by Bernini and also his brother, the Bernini family. As a matter of fact, this sort of leads me into an issue which I really wanted to improve, and that is to set up and continue a conservation restoration policy of some of those manuscripts. Because we did, in the past, the historic archive used to send some of their manuscripts for paper conservation to a laboratory run by quite a famous laboratory of conservation of paper, which is in Grottaferrata.
And it was close to the papal residence, the summer papal residence in Castel Gandolfo.
Exactly, exactly. But these kind of, they were quite rarely given. I mean, if by any chance, because of scholars who went to the historic archives and wanted to consult one of these documents, if that manuscript was very much ruined, then on, you know, sporadically they were sent over to be restored. Right now, what I've done is to set a real policy where we're having a systematic conservation of some of these manuscripts. So we have begun to set this as a real policy of the historical archives of the Fabrique. So right now, we do have a laboratory that is not very far from here that has taken on this task, this very important task, and we're just continuing. It's a systematic policy that has been initiated.
You are an art historian. You must love going back and feeling the pieces of paper that Bramante or Michelangelo or Raphael had written out a receipt of something or an order to perform some sort of architectural work. What is it like for you personally to go through these documents?
Well, it's a very exciting moment. Let me just give you an example. When we were preparing to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Basilica of St. Peter, I was given the task of preparing a major exhibit on the Basilica of San Pietro, and we called that exhibit Petros Eni. And as we were preparing for that exhibit, of course, there was a selection process of which documents to exhibit. And that was really an extraordinary, extraordinary moment, because we have some letters and documents autographed by Michelangelo that are extremely moving. Very moving. There is one in particular, for example, where he complains that the superintendent, that is the supervisor of his workmen, was not being paid. And so he had complained about this over and over again, and there was just no way that this poor man was being paid. So he writes a letter very angrily, and he says, "If you don't pay my supervisor, I will address the Pope himself, because I've put my body and soul in the construction of St. Peter. And just reading that line was just so moving, to think that this extraordinary genius, you know, who had a very, very strong human, you know, human emotions, he was a real character, a real personality, but who admits in black and white, you know, that he has put his whole being in this extraordinary project. And here you have a letter, a document, where his whole feeling is in there. That was a very moving experience.
And a very special thanks there to Cristina Carlostella, the general manager of the Fabrica of St. Peter's, the office responsible for the maintenance and daily care of the basilica. More than 1 billion people today make up the Catholic Church, a worldwide faith that besides running churches, parishes, and episcopal conferences, also operates schools, seminaries, and hospitals. Just think how such a global institution could run amok if it didn't have rules and regulations to keep things running smoothly on both a doctrinal level and on an administrative level. These regulations are contained in the Code of Canon Law. The current Code of Canon Law was issued in 1983 and represents the fruit of years of hard work in the years following the Second Vatican Council. At that time, Pope John XXIII announced that he wanted the old 1917 legislative code to be revised to include the doctrinal aspects outlined during the council. Unlike the military weapon, canon in the Catholic Church means to rule or rule of law. And just as a nation's laws are divided up into articles in a code of law, the Church's legislation is divided into canons. The 1,752 canons make up the universal law of the Church and include the rights and obligations of the faithful and the clergy, rules regarding the sacraments, Catholic schools, and bishops' conferences, just to name a few. But some things, like liturgical rules and the laws governing the causes of the saints and beatifications, the Roman Curia, and the rules of the conclave, are not contained in the pages of this big, thick, red book. While the Vatican office responsible for interpreting these canons and ensuring that they're easily understood and up to date with the changing times is the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts. Well, I sat down with the council's undersecretary, Monsignor Bernard Hebda, who told me more about the office.
We're a very small office. I suspect we're the smallest dicastery in the Holy See. So we have a president, a vice president, and a secretary. And then we have, in addition to myself, we have five canonists who work in the office. And we have a librarian. And we have some others who help us with the work as well. But because we're such a small staff, and we're international in the sense that we have one priest from Brazil, one priest from Spain, I'm from the United States. Everybody else is, of the canonists would be Italian. Of our superiors, our president's Italian, our secretary is Spanish. But because we're so small, we really rely on a body of consultors. And also the members of the council would be approximately 15 cardinals. But then it's these consultors who really give us the possibility of studying profoundly the questions that are presented to the council. They're really drawn from canonical experts around the world. Some of them would be pastors, would be bishops. Some of them would be working in tribunals. Some would be professors. We have a mix between bishops, priests, and lay people, and really globally diverse. And so if we have a question that is posed to this council, we would do some preliminary research, and then when we would have the opportunity to really understand the question, we might ask two or three consultors to offer us their opinion on the question as well. If they find that it's an area that needs to be developed or needs to be clarified, we would then convoke the members, the cardinal members. Most of the members are cardinals. We have a few who are bishops, so we have one patriarch. And then the members would really then have the opportunity to look at a question to decide whether it needs to be interpreted authentically. And that's happened relatively rarely in recent years, but it was something that was more common in the years right after 1983 when the code was promulgated.
What does interpreted authentically mean?
It's interesting. So if there's a question in the actual text of the code, there's an ambiguity there that needs to be clarified. The code itself provides for something called authentic interpretation. And the authentic interpretation, which the Holy Father has entrusted to this pontifical council, has the same weight as the law itself. So, for example, whenever this council has issued an authentic interpretation, always with the consent of the Holy Father, who authorizes the publication of the authentic interpretation, that interpretation would have the same rank as the law itself.
You've been here over a decade.
Yes.
Have you ever had an experience of a pope coming to you, Pope John Paul perhaps, or this pope, coming and saying, I want you to look at this law, I'm not satisfied with the way it's written?
They've never come personally to our offices to do that. At the same time, there have been a number of instances where the Holy Father, usually working through the Secretary of State, has asked this council to examine either a particular canon or the way in which the canon is being applied. For example, a few years back, this council was involved in the promulgation of a document, an instruction. It's called an instruction, Dignitas Connubii, about how marriage tribunals are to proceed in annulment case, in cases of nullity of marriage. And that was something that was entrusted to this council specifically by Pope John Paul. And so there was that kind of an interest. Pope Benedict has also shown a great interest in the nuts and bolts of our work. And we're very grateful for that. In fact, we're here to serve the Holy Father, who, interestingly enough, we often think of so many other titles for the Holy Father, but he's also the legislator. And so he really is at the heart of our work.
How does the canon law within the Vatican deal with such things as theft? Do these people go to some sort of Vatican court? Is there any kind of a trial? How does the code deal with these sort of things?
Well, you're asking the wrong person, because actually it's not so much a question of canon law, but Vatican City State has its own laws. And so they also have their own courts. There's an interesting volume that the secretary of this pontifical council just put out that really collects the laws of Vatican City State. And it's fascinating to read the different areas in which there's legislation that's for anything that would happen within the Vatican itself. And so really you would want to talk to somebody that would be more involved with that, especially through the governatorato. And then there's a court of appeals. Often they might make reference to the canon law of the church, universal law, but it's a particular law for Vatican City.
I see. And how do you work with, for example, the Roman Rota?
We wouldn't be working with them on an everyday basis. Their work is essentially judicial, whereas ours is legislative. Mm-hmm. And so obviously we want to... when there are questions that might touch on the work of the Rota, we would obviously consult them, and vice versa. The dean of the Rota, for example, is a very highly respected consultor in the work of this council. And so there have been times where we've drawn upon his insights or the insights of other Rota auditors to help us in our work. So getting back to that instruction that I talked about before, Dignitas Connubii, it was an interesting collaboration between a number of dicasteries. And so it wasn't really just this pontifical council, even though it was directed by the president of this council, but it also would have involved the Rota and the Signatura and the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. So really it's all different areas are involved in the law. But in terms of trying to understand the relationship with the Rota, I think it's best just to think about it in terms of the Rota's work being judicial, whereas ours is primarily legislative.
One of the issues which has concerned the church in fairly recent years is the issue of the abuse by priests. Have you seen the necessity of revising canon law in order to meet these new pressing problems?
It's always been recognized as one of the most grave crimes for a priest to be involved in any way in a crime against the Sixth Commandment with somebody who's a minor. And so even in our present code, in Canon 1395, paragraph 2, the Church has set forth very clearly that that person is to receive what the Church would consider to be a just penalty, but also it could be the gravest of penalties, which would be the dismissal from the clerical state, which for priests would be, it really reflects the fact that the Church understands this as being a very grave matter, a very grave crime. How, of course, you proceed based on this canon 1395.2 has to be developed in different ways. Obviously, we already have tribunals that function and that might be considering this canon. But there have also been subsequent documents from the Holy See that have really specified how that's to be treated. Episcopal conferences have really been at the forefront. And so, for example, the Episcopal Conference of the United States, working always in collaboration with the Holy See, promulgated a document called the Essential Norms, dealing with how those cases were to be treated in the United States. And so it would be primarily taken care of by the particular law of the place where the delict took place. Also, within the Holy See, the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith has its own tribunal, and Pope John Paul provided that they would be exclusively competent to deal with those cases when they came to the level of the Holy See. And so there was, in fact, a special document for that, and both with procedural norms and substantive norms that Pope John Paul directed, really regulating the way that those cases are conducted and making sure that justice is done and that just penalties are indeed given to any priest that would have committed such a grave delict.
You said that the first code, the 1917 code, it was John the 23rd who decided by the 1960s that it was time to review that code. Does it take about every 50 years for the code to be totally reviewed, or is this work that you're doing such that it is under continual review?
I would say the latter in some senses, in that interpretation and the possibility of authentic interpretation provides that opportunity, some flexibility in the law even before a new code would come out. And so there is always an evaluation of the canons and the opportunity to tweak the canons when there's a need to do that, always with the approval of the legislator, of course.
The legislator being the Pope.
The Holy Father, exactly. Being that we've only had two codes of canon law in the Church, the 1917 and the 1983, it's kind of hard to say what can be expected in terms of the revision of a code. Certainly it was the experience with the 1917 code that by the time they were 25 years out, they realized there were some things that needed to be clarified. Mm-hmm. And I would guess that will be the case here as well.
What preceded the 1917 code?
There were lots and lots of laws in the Church. So really from the very beginning of the Church, because it had to have an institutional structure, there were always going to be norms. And so you had over history, you had certain great legal minds that tried to gather all of those different norms and to organize them. And so somebody like Gracian, for example, really put together a brilliant work organizing all of the norms that he was able to find for the within the purview of the church.
Now, sorry, back in 1917, there certainly weren't, how many did you say here?
1752.
Right. Canons.
Right. There were more.
There were more.
So one of the ideas with the 1983 code was to really reduce some of those things, and some of the things that would have been treated in the 1917 code no longer appear in the code, but would be in separate legislations. For example, the norms concerning causes of saints. Before, there would have been some reference to that in the 1917 code. Now that's something that's completely outside of the 1983 code. But it was to make it clearer, more simple. That was the desire.
You seem to really like this job. What's your favorite part of it?
Well, to be honest with you, I enjoy working with the people in the office. We've been able to bring a great pastoral dimension to the work, because so often when you hear Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts, you just think of somebody working in a room with dusty volumes and all of these Latin texts. I've really been blessed in working with superiors who have helped us to see that there are always people behind the questions that are presented to us. And everything that we do really is going to have an impact on the faithful. And so being able to see how some of our work has helped clarify things for some people or given them a new sense of belonging in the church has been very, very helpful, encouraging. One of the pleasant aspects of the work here in the council is really working with a broad section of canonists and also students of canon law. And so we always welcome canon law societies, for example, when they come to Rome, they're always welcome to bring their members here, and we'll talk about our work and what's going on in their country. The same with the different faculties of canon law. It's almost routine for them to come at least once a year, once every 2 years for the foreign faculties, to come and really to discuss with us what our work has been and the issues that they see as well. So that's been very positive. Our new president, Archbishop Coco Palmerio, and our new secretary, Monsignor Arieta, Juan Ignacio Arieta, both have wonderful reputations as scholars, and they've spoken all over the world. But the rest of us are here waiting for people to come to visit us, and we're happy to do that.
And a very warm thanks there to Monsignor Bernard Hebda, the Undersecretary of the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.